Hi there. Welcome to the Agency Toolkit Podcast, a podcast where we discuss stories, strategies, and techniques to help you build a successful and profitable digital marketing agency. Our episodes contain inspiring conversations with CEOs and entrepreneurs and leave you with actionable tips, ideas, and strategies you can implement into your business today. We are happy to have you with us. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and get inspired.
Hello, and thank you for tuning into another episode of the Agency Toolkit. I'm your host, Julia McLaughlin. This episode is sponsored by ReviewRobin, a review management software for marketing agencies to help you guys get your clients more positive reviews. You can check that out at getreviewrobin.com. Our guest is Kent Lewis, who is the president and founder of Anvil Media. Lewis oversees strategic direction of the company with a focus on sales and marketing. And he also speaks internationally and writes for publications like Portland Business Journal and Smart Brief. Today, we're going to be discussing Kent's journey as an entrepreneur and what he's learned along the way. And we're also going to be touching on the fact that his agency was recently acquired. So thanks so much for joining us today, Kent.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's dive into a couple questions so our listeners can get to know you a little bit. So how did you get into digital marketing?
That's a wonderful question. And it was a little bit serendipitous, but I graduated from college with a degree in business with a marketing concentration. And here I am running an agency that does marketing. So I more or less am using the degree, yet I had no practical skills when I left college. So I started out in high-tech PR, public relations, and that agency spun off. So I moved to Portland in early 95. And within a month, I was helping them spin out another agency that was a web development shop. They didn't even know what to call it back then. Mm-hmm. Website building company. I don't even know what they called it. It was kind of funny. But I helped them do some initial research. I got to know their team. I did their pro bono PR so that they built us a website. They were located downstairs. And one day their head of sales came over and asked me, hey, would you be willing to be our marketing person and market our agency? And I said, yeah, I wanted to get out of PR, not because I don't love the discipline, because I still do PR, I'm a fan, but because I didn't like the managers that managed me. So I moved to the sister company, of which some of them were the same partners in that business as well. And I knew something was different when one of the main partners that I left because I didn't like him, I thought he was a terrible person. He came downstairs the first day I started. It was maybe at 10 o'clock. I was 2 hours into my first day as an internet marketer. And he came down, he's like, Kent, I got a question about the internet. I knew from that day forward, something was different because he wouldn't give me the time of day upstairs. I moved downstairs and suddenly I'm an expert just because I changed my title and worked for a web design firm. So I decided, well, if he's going to ask me, I better figure out how to be an expert. So I took it from there. I started building disciplines or services. Then I went to different agencies and I started building teams at the next agency. And then after I co-founded an agency in 99 and parted ways with that agency because I had a falling out with the partner, which I am the senior founding member and majority shareholder, I decided I better work for myself. And so in October 2000, I started Anvil just as a shingle because I didn't really want to work for myself and I didn't really want to have employees. But after doing one regular job and one startup, I decided I want to run my own show. I want to run it my way and I'm not afraid to hire employees. So that was really fall of 03 by the time I did that. And I've had, the Anvil team ever since up until March 1st, I am now a Dexia employee that still runs Anvil until we integrate the two. And then I'll be an evangelist for both brands.
Okay. Well, that's so interesting. So let's talk a little bit about the process of, how you got acquired. And so what was your experience like going through that whole process?
Oh, man. So I'll try and keep this as short as possible. I know we have a certain amount of runtime here. So the first thing is, over the last 20 years, I'll say realistically 15 years, I have had people asking if I was interested in selling, and I've taken it varying degrees of depth. I went to my first letter of intent, LOI, where a company gives you general terms and says, we want to buy you 4 years ago. But before that, I had 5 or 6 very serious conversations. I just didn't get to LOI. But it was probably 10 years, back in 2007, so many years ago, I joined EO, Entrepreneur Organization. And that's where I started to learn how to build a business more effectively. Mm-hmm. That not so much to scale, because I wanted to have a very small boutique and I achieved that goal, but to build a company that would maximize valuation while balancing my goal to have a lifestyle business. So what that means is, if there's a fork in the road where I had to make a decision as an agency owner, and one of them would be more profitable and one would be a better lifestyle, but less profitable, most of the time I went for lifestyle. But I found that most of my decisions weren't either or. So, you know, lifestyle, the biggest choice I made was not to grow for growth's sake, just to get to a certain revenue so I could high five myself or afford a Ferrari or something like that. It was, I'm going to build a very small, very effective boutique agency with a dozen or so people that's big enough to pay my bills so I don't have to do the billable work, but small mm-hmm. enough so I don't have the more people, more problems, right? So
right.
I built effectively a lifestyle business that was highly profitable for the most part, for most of those years, right? There's always some ups and downs. So the first thing that I, long before I talked to Dexia, about 10 years ago, I figured out my number. And you know what? That number has not changed, unfortunately. Meaning, 10 years ago, my valuation was actually twice as high. I had a few more employees. I had a bit more profit. But back then, 10 years ago, revenue multipliers or EBITDA multiplier was more like 8 to 10x. And now it's mm-hmm. down to 4 to 5x, right?
Oh, gotcha.
So I still hit my number and more or less in the deal, my target. In the way we structure it, it's just that it was harder to fight for that, even though we're really healthy financially. Mm-hmm. The multipliers have been compressing and they're not going to go up. They're just going to keep going down.
Interesting.
So what I did was I started to incorporate what I'll call deal friendly reporting into my business process, so that I had documents that I would just upload to a Google Drive. And then when somebody would query me, I would say, well, let's sign an NDA. And then if I liked them, we'd sign an NDA. Then I'd do a deeper dive. And if they still, I didn't scare them away, I'd say, here's the Google Drive, go nuts. And they would look at our financials, our operations, our, you know, everything about the business that I thought they needed to know. Mm-hmm. And so, because the number one pitfall you hear is it's highly distracting to go through the M&A process. And that's totally true. So I try to eliminate that by saying, if somebody came in cold, I didn't know, I'd say, have a call. If that went well, go to NDA. Then I go to discovery, light discovery. Then one of those went to an LOI. And then after that LOI fell apart, I went to another agency, approached me, and we got all the way to a sale agreement, skipped an LOI, straight to a sale agreement because we knew each other. And then I got cold feet 3 years ago because I didn't think the culture fit was there. So my big lesson there was, I don't follow almost every rule there is that I've been told through my cousin who was an M&A expert, Kellogg, Wharton educated, worked with the big M&A firms. You know, you never put out the first number, you never show your cards, and it's a dance. And so I did the opposite. I said, here's my number. And they either turned them off and saved me a ton of time or mm-hmm. not. But the bottom line is I was not interested in wasting my time at all. So the next thing I did was kept an open mind. I learned from every single interaction. So let's say I had, up until this Dexia deal, which we started talking a year and a half ago, mm-hmm. and the number was a little too high for them. And my number felt a little too low for me. And what he did right, the CEO, Aaron, is he checked in with me every quarter. How's it going? How's business? Have you sold yet? Are you interested in selling? And I just kept putting him off. And then one day I was sitting in my office here next to my wife at our home office, and he called and I put on speaker and he's like, we need to do this deal. I'm tired of waiting and I'm ready. And are you ready? And I was like, well, let's talk. And so we went through the process. And what I liked about it was that every other time I've had conversations, and this one came up because of EO, Entrepreneur Organization, but also a tool called Opportunity Networks, which is free for EO members, where you can go and post your business for sale. So a year and a half ago, the reason I got the first inquiry was I just posted one paragraph about Anvil and open to entertaining offers because I was happy, I was profitable. It was exactly the right time to sell because I wasn't unhappy and ready to sell for any price.
Yeah.
And I got half a dozen inquiries. I entertained all of them. But only one or two got really far down, and one was Dexia, but we parted ways because the numbers, we couldn't make them work. And then a year later, we made the, year and a half later, we did the deal. So my lesson was, I want to get back to it. The other four or five, they would pump me up. And then once they thought they got me hooked, then they would beat me down. Like, you're not special. Your company isn't worth any more than anybody else's. Da 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 da. And I'm just like, you should do that at the negotiate, when you're at the tail, when you figured out the number, then you're trying to get the number down right before you close. That's when you typically beat people up, not like when you're still courting them. So I told him to go take a hike. So there is that delicate balance of trying to maximize your, as a buyer, the price. Mm-hmm. But in that case, they just deeply offended me.
Right.
And so the other thing I would say is, beyond looking to sell when you don't want to sell, that's when you have the most leverage, is I learned the hard way not to count your chickens before they hatch, because I'm a guy that doesn't count, I don't spend money I don't have. 3 years ago, sale agreement, there were only two terms that we had to work out. It was going to be a done deal. Then I had lunch with a friend of mine that the deal was delayed 3 weeks because of the loan. And I was supposed to be having lunch to celebrate and tell him, hey, dude, I sold. And instead, I was telling him, I'm about to sell. And he's like, are you just stupid? Or did you hit your head? And he outlined why this deal wasn't going to work, because he knew me and he knew the other company, because we're on EO. And he talked me out of it, basically. So the next day I went to the Portland International Auto Show, and I was looking at, I'm a BMW fan, and they had this little hot rod there. And I was like, I think I'm going to buy that car. You know, I'm gonna sell the business. I mean, we're at the 11th hour. We're a week away from closing. I'm gonna do this. And I did the quick check. If the deal falls through because he backs out, the other buyer, then am I okay having this car? Can I afford this car? I decided I want this car. I can afford this car. I bought the car. And the day after I picked it up, I backed out of the deal. So the money didn't come in, right?
Yeah.
I still ended up with my a hot rod that I enjoy. But I counted the chickens before they hatched, but I could absorb that.
Right.
A mistake, but it was a little aggressive. Go ahead.
So I'd love to know, what were the red flags that your associate mentioned, your friend mentioned, when you guys went out to lunch about the deal?
So that is such a great question. So the biggest challenge that entrepreneurs have in being an EO, and I'm not openly trying to plug it, but I'm in a group of service-based businesses like agencies, but we don't compete with each other. And there was one day where a guy was, one of our meetings where he was asking for everybody's advice on selling his business. And we all chimed in, and we kind of unintentionally were telling him not to sell. And then, when you're in a forum, you're not supposed to give advice. You just share experiences. But our experience shares were, this guy happened to be an M&A advisor that talked me out of it. He was like, you'll never have more freedom. You'll never make more money. Because if you think about it, the multiple of EBITDA, your profit, is if you're willing to sell for five, that should be 5 years of profit, right? So I told myself I would never sell for less than 2 years of profit, at least up front, right? But instead, I ended up totally doing that, because I took a lower upfront payment, a higher monthly payment over 4 years, because I probably saved 40% on taxes.
Oh,
and then, and a little bit of equity. So I had skin in the game in this new entity, right? So I did it the exact opposite of how most people want to get a big check and get the hell out. I didn't want to get out. I love what I do, but this is why the original deal was, they were going to kill the Anvil brand. They were going to mitigate me and just basically stay around for a year and then get out, unless you love it. And they didn't like or get along with my VP, who is my right hand and the central person in my company that I'm friends with and I care about. They didn't like each other. And then when I visited his office I hosted a meeting there, and I took two steps and I was like, this will never work. I had not visited their office yet to get a sense of their culture. So that was my big mistake, was I mentioned saving time by putting the money first, or putting the number first. Well, I figured, well, let's get all the numbers out of the way first, then we'll worry about fit. That was a huge mistake. Fit first. So we spent a year and a half, Dexy and I, confirming the culture. In fact, I flew out and met his entire team, because he told them early. I didn't tell my team until the day of the day before the transaction. Was I instantly knew there was a culture simpatico. It was like Anvil East, right? It was beautiful. So that was one thing. So all the things he was checking out: the freedom, the money, the control, the blah blah blah. Well, I'm as much as I am enjoying working with and managing my team and I'm okay at it, it's been 22 years of that. I'm done. Like, so what they wanted me to do is be their evangelist and head up their marketing. And that's what I've been doing all my life. It's not even work to me. I enjoy it. So I get to go from taking it, instead of only 20% of my day being what I love and the rest being an obligation. I mean, I don't mind sales, but if I take 80 to 90% off my plate and then pay me a decent amount for the next 4 years, I'm in.
Yeah. And then be sounds a like part a great plan.
Yeah. Now we're 40 employees instead of 11. Right. So now there's more momentum. I can go help them close bigger deals and grow the business. So what the other guys talked me out of, I learned, I checked every box. I have a wonderful amount of freedom and control within a box that I want to be in. Mm-hmm. And even though my wife and I disagree how comfortable I'll be as an employee for the first time in over two decades, I'm looking forward to it. And I'm also a managing partner, right? So I'm an equity shareholder and I'm part of the executive team more or less. So I will still have some say and guidance on how to get, you know, my own investment back, right?
Yep.
But I don't have to be burdened with all the problems that I've been absolutely 100% liable for 20 years. To me, exactly. That's absolutely essential. But really, if I were to say the reason that I sold, my team, first of all, my team comes first, and at 11 people, there was a very limited amount of growth I could offer them. You know, there's only like two titles, right, in each division, in each discipline, not much there. So I could give them a huge path with, you know, our goal is to be 18 million in the next 3 years. And right now combined we're at 5. So we have a ways to go, but they have a roadmap and we're a part of that. And then there'll probably be other acquisitions and other growth strategies. Number two is my clients. It's harder to take care of my clients when I only 11 employees, if somebody's sick or we have limited bandwidth or really limited skill sets. I now have a full service agency behind me. And we augment their weakest part, which is the digital, you know, search and social. That's 80 to 90% of what we do. They do everything else. So it's beautiful in that way.
Yeah.
And then the third was my wife has been operations for 5 years. She wants to do something else. Good for the marriage. And then lastly, good for me. You know, I get to do what I love. So if you check those things off, is it a good, are you solving problems you couldn't solve on your own? That's why I did this, because I couldn't, or I was not willing to try to hire somebody else to take over all this other stuff. I was too small to do that. So this made a lot of sense. The other thing I didn't do that you're supposed to do, you're supposed to shop the deal, bring in an M&A firm. They put a package together. They shop it around. You're supposed to get a 2 to 3x increase in value. I wasn't interested in that because I knew that I'd have to scour the planet to find another agency with a similar culture, with alignment and values and the willingness to just put me in a place I want to be and be happy about it where they actually had the need. So I knew I wasn't going to shop it for the money. I didn't structure the deal for the money. Like literally I'm taking most of the risk right now, frankly. And I'm totally okay with it because I believe in what we've built here.
Yeah.
And I think the other critical messaging about this being a merger, even though they acquired our assets, he's like, it's a merger because you're here and you're a critical part of the team, is for my team and my clients, they know I'm staying. That creates much less risk for them and much less risk for me because everybody's sticking around, right? That's the theory.
Right, okay.
And I'll leave you with this, having been 4 days into this, so I'm very seasoned now, I'm very sage, is that couldn't celebrate until the money hits the bank, right? Until the wire transfer hits. It wasn't even that big of a transfer anyway. And then when you structure a deal a certain way, if you keep the accounts receivable, then that money's all out in the ether. Your clients haven't paid you yet. So I ended up paying him a bigger check just to get all the prepaid media we had. We had to give it over to him because that's money that was not ours. It was our clients' prepaid media advertising dollars.
Right.
And then there was other pending charges. So, you know, I wrote him a bigger check than he wrote me. And now over the next 2 or 3 months, I'll be keeping every check that comes in. But so my down payment really has now been deferred over. That was my choice. Because typically what happens is they discount the receivables. You know, I'll discount your after 30 days, 30%, after 50 days, 80% or whatever. I was like, I want to keep 100% of my receivables because I know they'll come in. It's like, okay, that's your choice. But that meant I wrote a big check back. So be ready for that, right? So I couldn't really celebrate when the money hit the bank because it went right back out. And then there's also just like all the busyness of getting all the tying up the books after 20 something years. is kind of painful. So we have a hangover for a month or two, and we'll have there'll be 3 to 6 months where I'm still going to be in my role. So the good news, I did it now. So I know that the stakes in the sand, and then I, at some point, will be just a CMO, but for now I'm kind of dual role, but mainly running the team. That's okay. As I said, I sold when I was happy. So it's not a problem for me, but that's why you sell when you're happy, so that if there's this longer time ramp up or ramp off ramp that you weren't ready for, that you're not just totally killing yourself. So yeah. I'm going to meet a bunch of my entrepreneur friends this weekend at an offsite in Central Oregon. And they're probably going to think I'm going to roll in with a Lamborghini and Crevassier and a Rolex. And I'm like, my bank account is like literally empty right now, and it'll be refilled over time. But like, you know, it'll be a very humble celebration. You know what I mean? I still have a lot of work ahead.
Right.
So it's not what you think it is, unless you do that other upfront deal and carry a box out with your belongings. I didn't do that. But yeah. So that's good to have a future podcast where somebody talks through that experience.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And then, so what ways would you recommend that you can, what can you do to maximize your evaluation?
So to maximize valuation, it's all about profit. It's 90% about profit, because that's the risk factor. So the more profitable, the more valuable. Mm-hmm. Again, if you're a $5 million agency running a 20% margin at a 5x EBITDA, it's 1x revenue. It's $5 million valuation for an agency. The secret sauce is typically, once you get to 10 million in revenue, and say if you can get to 2 to 3 million in EBITDA or profit, then you're looking at that, then you start to become a $15 million purchase. And you know what I mean? It starts to go up. And the multiplier goes up as you're bigger. You might end up with a 6 or 7x multiplier. So profit, you know, I sold for a bigger number than a company, it might be 5 times larger, but with less profit. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's better, you know, in the agency world, I've always tried to target north of 20% margin. And for the most part, I've been able to hit that for most of the years. But the big agencies, the global agencies, are like 8%. And the big regionals are like 10 to 15%. And it's not until you get smaller where you actually might have a higher margin.
Okay.
But it's harder to make that kind of money. So if you can just look at, as you look at agency lists and look at their revenue, but keep in mind, capitalized billings is BS. That involves ad spend and a multiplier. It should be fees, you know, revenue. I don't count my media and my valuation. That's mm-hmm. passed through. So the people that do are actually should be paying tax on it. And that makes them stupid, frankly, to pay taxes on pass-through revenue or pass-through media.
Right.
So we keep it mean. So profitability, IP, that's the other component. I didn't have any IP, any intellectual property. So if you can create more value by having something unique to your business, in the agency world, that's really hard to do unless you literally build software. It's hard to create IP around a process in the agency world because it's all been done. Mm-hmm. So you build a tool, you build some sort of asset. That's another way to maximize valuation. And the other way is just to have really clean books, like really clean numbers where you have month to month, you know, you can just throw it through QuickBooks or your accounting. If you get your numbers audited, at least before you go shopping, they make sure that numbers are all verified and clean by a CPA or more so an accounting firm. Mm-hmm. That's a good way to make sure when you have clean numbers, it's kind of like being pre-approved for a house. It gives you more leverage.
Right.
Those are the big ones. And then the other one is the bus test. If I get hit by a bus, can that company still operate? The company is worth more to a certain kind of buyer if I'm not needed.
Yes.
In this case, that didn't matter. They wanted me. So the bus test, I wasn't able to pass it, and they didn't care because they have the bus. They drive a bus, and they just wanted me to be a particular passenger with a specific, you know, responsibility.
So what are some tips for passing the bus test?
Passing the bus test. So having checks and balances, processes, I think our secret sauce all these years, you know, has been our processes. So when I look at, you know, people, processes, you know, our clientele, our service mix, our tools, when I look at what influences what, it all comes down to process. That's at the core. Mm-hmm. Because the reason that's true, that it trumps even your employees, is in 2013, I blew the company up and rebuilt it. I lost half of my employees when I said, here's our new credo, you're in or you're out, half the team left. And that was 7 of 14. So my VP and I had to go rush to find people with a pulse, and it took years to rebuild the team. back to a decent level. Mm-hmm. So for the first 2 years, we had 100% employee turnover. We should have been out of business, but our processes kept the glue. It was the glue that held us together while we were rebuilding the plane as we were taking off or going off a cliff, whatever metaphor you want to use there. Mm-hmm. So the process was key. And then it's having, you know, good enough people, if not great people, that can execute on the process. So there's a tool set, a methodology called Entrepreneur Operating System, EOS.
Yes.
And it's basically, right, it's for the entrepreneurs because we have very little discipline. We're not very organized. Just to overgeneralize. So it's discipline, it's structure, it's accountability, it's problem solving. So all these things that I had not implemented EOS in a deep way at Anvil, but Nexia is way into it. They're 5 years into EOS. So we're going to introduce that to our team. I'm familiar with it, but I'm just now learning how to implement it in our business as we integrate the two companies. And it's a lot more rigor than I'm used to, but there's a purpose and there's an outcome there that I look for. So I would highly recommend EOS or an equivalent system because it can actually increase the valuation. Because if a buyer knows you have EOS, they know that you've passed a lot of BS tests because you can't really fake it in EOS for any length of time.
No,
so,
it's true.
Yeah, that's an important element, I would say. And you know, so, you know, core processes, building is best, the best team you can, and then layer on great clients. And what I mean is I have fired clients that were huge revenue for us that violated our no asshole client policy. And it was painful and unfortunate to have to part ways with them, mm-hmm. but it was good to protect the team, their sanity and their respect. I think that goes a long way. And then lastly, using the right tools and partners to get everything done. If there's a right service mix. So the beauty is we outsourced web development, copywriting, graphic design, photography, video. That's everything that Dexia does. And so it's completely complementary. They do a little bit of what we do. And so we're going to look at the best of the tools and processes, and we're going to make a super company out of it, you know, of a discipline, you know, digital marketing discipline that's better than both combined. And so what I like about what Dexia did is they came in and instead of saying, this is how it's going to be, here's what everybody reports to, here's the chart, they said, let's meet with everybody first. Let's look at their strengths. Let's see where they fit. And let's re-engineer the chart of this new company. It truly is a merger in that way, right? They've already adopted a few of our processes, and it's only been 4 days. And we're starting to implement some of theirs as well. And then soon we'll just be fully integrated. Even if we keep the Anvil brand going, it will be more of a brand powered by Dexia, or a Dexia brand, whatever that is, at some time it may or may not ever sunset. And there will probably be other acquisitions as well where we'll fit them in some way. So, I mean, hopefully, so all of that comes together, you know, when this was effectively a very strategic buy. Strategic buyers will pay more than general financial investors that are just looking for a certain return. There's the kind of buyers that think that it's broken and they can make it better. Dexia knew better than to think we were broken. They're actually pulling parts off and putting them on their car. You know what I mean?
Right.
And we'll come up with a faster car.
Yeah.
Which is great because the other agency I said no to could care less. All they wanted, they were buying revenue. They were buying headcount. It was like an acquire, hiring people and bringing in clients. And they didn't care about our processes, our brand, any of that. And I was like, well, I can get past, for any amount of money, I could get past a certain amount of that and be humble. But I was like, but that's just dumb. We had, you know, we had 19 year track record back then. It doesn't make sense to kill that momentum.
Yeah.
Dexia agrees, you know, so we'll see how it goes later.
Awesome. Well, we're getting ready to wrap up here shortly. Do you have anything that you would like to add on the topic of acquisition?
I would say, you know, I will be writing an article about this and, you know, I'll keep you in the loop, but I have, I think, have the conversations, get it ready. Oh, here's my last tip. And this came from the guy that convinced me to not sell. He told me almost 10 years ago, if you think you're going to be selling in the next 2 years or more, start today by lowering your average bank balance. So basically every quarter I drain the accounts down to what was a safe level. I thought, you know, 1 month of operating or so, and then it'd go back up to 3 months and I'd take it down. So what happens is a savvy buyer will look back 18 to 24 months and say, what was your average bank balance? And that's what you have to keep in the company. So instead of keeping, let's say, $400,000 or $500,000 in the bank on average, I kept 150 in the bank. Mm. And that meant I got to keep the rest. right? Yeah. So most of my agency associates in Portland keep a huge balance because they're super conservative and they feel like they need to have that money in there. I'm like, well, you can do that. You could also keep it, have discipline and take it out and keep it in your account and then just put it back in if you need it. And that way, if you were to ever sell, you have a history of a lower bank balance.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. That's right? A really great tip. Yeah.
Yeah, that's you're awesome. Welcome on that one. I thought that was, I mean, I owe him a beverage for that. That was like, that ended up being a decent amount in retrospect, honestly.
That's really cool. Well, we're getting ready to wrap up here, but first we have the fast five, which are five rapid fire questions for you. So what's a book you've read that's made an impact on you?
Great question. I like The Boys in the Boat. It's by the gal that wrote Seabiscuit. And it was because it's a great story. It resonates because it's a Seattle-based story about the rowing crew in the Olympics that beat the Germans in Berlin in the 30s. And it had I had a business lesson in there is if I could put the people in the right seat on the boat and get them pulling it in unison, we could be more efficient, more effective, more profitable, and have more fun. So for the last 8 years since I read that, I've tried to integrate that concept with limited success, but I still love the book. And I love the idea of turning it into a mantra and a way to run a business.
Very cool. And what does your morning routine look like?
Morning routine is typically, I start with wake up, check my, you know, check email, check social. I typically post a few things for the day. Then I get on the bike and I stationary bike for half hour. And then, you know, once I shower and eat, pre-COVID, I go into work. Now that Omicron is sunsetting a little bit here, I'm going to probably go back into the office more. At least we'll be back to twice a week, which was our post-COVID deal. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, get home and hang out with the kids and maybe watch a Netflix series.
Nice. And is there a CEO that you follow or study?
CEO-wise, I think... CEO-wise, not as much. I think there's, you know, I've lost respect for Elon Musk, as smart as he is, a little bit for Richard Branson, definitely for Jeff Bezos, because all three of them are obsessed with rockets and going into space instead of solving world problems and crises with their billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So I mainly look at, like, other people inspire me would be Malcolm Gladwell and Seth Godin, Michael Lewis, for their really insightful writing and storytelling. That inspires me more. And there hasn't been a business book that's moved me in a long time. I just handed Clue Train Manifesto to one of the Dexia crew before they left. They just visited us. And I thought it inspired me. And then I also thought it's a Bible, it's big, but Dan Ariely, Predictably Irrational, was profoundly fascinating to me on why we do what we do. We're predictably stupid, frankly, as humans. And I think it's an essential reading if you're a marketer. Or somehow in the behavioral sciences.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. And then what is your favorite online tool?
Favorite online tool? It's probably Hootsuite. I'm kind of hooked on having a presence. I've been posting hourly on Twitter and now more so LinkedIn for the past 10 years. Hourly.
Hourly. Amazing.
Yeah. So it's my bag. And so I need that tool to manage that kind of flow.
Exactly. Definitely. So, and then last question, what's one thing you wish you had known when you began your career?
Oh man, I've got tons of writing. I'll just send you a link to an article I wrote on it. It's called, okay, here it is. It's on LinkedIn. My LinkedIn profile is Kent Lewis, one of those early adopters of LinkedIn. The title is What's Your Story? Write That Book. And it's a compilation inspired by Seth Godin. I had lunch with him in New York years ago, is I have articles about building a brand, articles about optimizing your business operations, articles about recruiting and career tips, and then articles about leadership. And every time I write one, I add it to this one article and I'll send it to you. But so basically, awesome. Yeah. So basically I hope that answers your question like 10 times over indirectly, but remind me what the actual question was, because I'll just cite one of the articles.
What's one thing you wish you had known when you began your career?
Stay close to the money. Of all the articles I mentioned, that probably the most often is that ostensibly you can't, if you are not in the flow of money, it's hard in a career to make money. And so by that, my uncle told me that when I graduated college, and I had no idea what he meant. I started in PR, and you're 2 degrees away from the money. I pitch to press. Press covers my client. The consumer reads the article, then pays the client for the whatever, and then we're over here getting the money. You know, we're 2 to 3 degrees away from the money flow. Once I moved to the internet in 96, and my boss came down and said, you know, hey, I have a question. And then our big client kept asking every Friday, fax in our numbers on our site traffic. I realized, wait a sec, I'm on the flow of money. Being in the internet is measuring the money, right? So that's why I realized, oh my gosh, I finally made it. And now when you own the business, you absolutely control the money, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's such great advice. I love it. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Ken. It was a pleasure to have you on the show, and I really appreciate you joining us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Agency Toolkit. We hope you've learned something new that you can implement into your agency today. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to our podcast, and we'll see you next time.